But in the end, I did. As we boarded a new bus in Denver, some girl slid into the seat beside me, dropped down into the chair like a plane crashing from the sky, and asked, "What's your baby's name?" I opened my mouth, but no sound came out. "What's the matter?" she asked. "Cat got your tongue?" The girl was all skin and bones, her cheeks hollowed in. She wore clothes that were too big on her, an unshapely coat that just drooped. Her hair was dark, her eyes dark. Around her neck she wore a dog collar with spikes. "No, it's..." I stuttered, unable to come up with a name. "She's gotta have a name, don't she?" Not even flinching when I couldn't tell her my baby's name. Of course I couldn't say the baby's name was Calla. Then she might have known. "How about Ruby?" she asked then, as she gazed out the window, watching as the bus bypassed a Ruby Tuesday restaurant on the side of the road. There it sat, right before the expressway entrance. Karma, I believed. I stared at those words, the big, bold red letters. I'd never known anyone named Ruby before. I thought of that brilliant red gemstone, red, the color of blood. "Ruby," I repeated, as if tasting the word in my mouth, savoring it. And then, "I like it. Yeah, Ruby," I said again. And she said, "Ruby," ingraining the word in my mind. The girl had a bruise the size of Mount Everest on her head, slashes across a wrist that she tried to cover by yanking down the sleeve of a green coat. She caught the bus in Denver, and by Omaha she was gone. I tried not to look at the bruise, but my eyes found it near impossible not to stray to the purple goose egg on her head. "What?" she asked nonchalantly. "This?" She swept her hair down to cover the bruise. "Let's just say my boyfriend's an ass," she said, and then asked me, "What brings a girl like you out on the road in the middle of the night with," she adds, pinching the baby's tiny nose, "a babe?" We got to talking, that girl and me. She had a low-key approach that I liked, a way of holding my eyes when she talked. "Let's just say we needed a change of scenery," I said, and with that, we stopped asking about where we were going and where we'd been, because we both knew the other had come from someplace ugly. We had a stopover in Kearney, Nebraska, during which time the girl poured a bottle of reddish hair dye over my head, and I did the same to her. It didn't sit long enough, and so instead of ginger hair, as depicted on the box, I remained snot-colored, tinged with red. The girl shimmied out of a pair of torn jeans and a sweater. "Here," she said, thrusting the clothing into my already jam-packed hands. "Switch." I slipped the baby into her tattooed hands, a half-butterfly on each palm that, when pressed together, made it complete. "A tiger swallowtail," she said when I asked. In the stall of the bathroom, the walls covered with ink, "Benny loves Jane," and "Rita is a gay," I took off the pants Matthew had given me and pulled the sweatshirt up over my head. I left on the undershirt the one dotted with Joseph's blood. This I couldn't dare let her see. I slipped on that girl's clothing, the jeans and sweater, a hooded coat the color of green olives and leather boots with frayed brown shoelaces. When I emerged from the stall, she was holding the baby in a single arm, a safety pin in her right hand. "What's that for?" I asked, watching as she removed a course of earrings from her ear. An angel's wings, a cross, red lips. "It'll only hurt for a second," she replied. And with that, I held the baby while she thrust that pin through my ear and set the earring inside the swollen lobes. I screamed, squeezing the baby unintentionally, and "Ruby," she screamed too. We tossed the empty bottles of hair dye into the trash, and then the girl pulled me close, streaking eyeliner across my eyes. I'd never worn makeup before, nothing other than a hint of pale pink rouge Mama swept across my cheeks every now and then. I looked at myself in the filmy mirror. The hair, the earring, the dark, mysterious eyes. The reflection that stared back was anything but mine. "What's her name?" she asked, slipping the eyeliner into my pocket, the pocket of that green coat that used to be hers. And then she took a pair of scissors to my hair. I didn't object. I held very still, watching in the mirror as she snipped erratic strands from my head. "You know," she confessed, tossing the wet clumps of hair to the bathroom tile, "I used to want to be a beautician." I stared at my reflection and thought at best that she was not. My mop was misshapen, longer on one side than the other, lanky bangs that hid my eyes. My mother was a beautician, I said, then wondered what Mama would think of me now. Would she be disappointed in me, or would she see that I was doing what needed to be done? I was taking good care of Lily, just like I told her I would. My name is Claire.
Claire?
She asked, and I nodded my head.
Claire what?
Her own reddish hair, she'd dyed dirty blonde. She took the scissors to her hair, too, and on the dingy floor the strands coalesced.
Claire Dalloway?
She tossed it all in the trash, the scissors, the safety pin, what she could collect of the hair from that floor. She opened her own bag and dumped its guts into the bin, a torn magazine, an ID, a half-eaten bag of Skittles, a phone. And then she reached inside the black garbage bag and snatched the Skittles, having changed her mind. The rest she left behind. The girl was standing in the bathroom, hand on the door. Someone on the other side knocked, a heavy thumping blow.
"Hang on!"
she snapped. And then to me. "I'm Willow," she said. "Willow Greer." And I knew after she left that bathroom, I'd never lay eyes on her again.
"I'll meet you at the bus,"
she fudged, and with that, I hoisted the slipping baby onto a hip and watched my former self walk out the yellowing veneer door and into the gas station, past a line of waiting women who'd lost their patience. She wasn't on the bus when I returned.
Heidi. She will have nothing to do with the bottle. I try again and again to set the formula-filled bottle into Juliet's mouth, but she'll have nothing to do with it. I press my lips to her forehead. It's cool. No fever. I change her diaper and attempt to pacify her. I spread diaper rash cream onto a healed rash, but nothing will do. Nothing will soothe my child. And it's in the way that she nuzzles her nose into the black crepe dress that the answer comes to me. The answer, utterly simple. That one thing only a mother can provide. I sit down in the rocking chair, and reaching behind me with a single arm, begin to unfasten the mismatched buttons up my back, sliding my arms out of the dress so that before Juliet, I am exposed. Nothing she hasn't seen before, I think, recalling those nights in my mind when I sat down with Juliet in the sleigh glider in the nursery with its pale pink walls and damask sheets, and pressed her to my breast so she could drink her fill until her hunger eased and she drank herself asleep, her eyes slowly becoming too heavy to hold open. And there, in the nursery, with only the glow of the moon to keep us company, my Juliet would suckle until she drifted to sleep. I recall the way she would slurp insatiably at times, staring at me with her huge brown anime eyes, as if I was the best thing in the world, her eyes filled to the brim with love and awe. Love and awe for me. But Juliet, I'm noticing, eyeing the child before me, Juliet's eyes are blue. It's no matter, I tell myself, knowing how baby's eyes can change on a dime. Brown one minute, blue the next. And yet there's something different about it, about those eyes, about the way they stare at me. I place my breast beside Juliet's mouth and watch in admiration as she locates the nipple. And as she latches on, I find it all so familiar, the tingling sensation in my breast, the release of oxytocin that fills me with a sense of calm. I run a hand across my Juliet's head and whisper, "There now, pretty baby," as I watch for the rhythmic sucking and swallowing action, for the big brown eyes to stare at me with awe. Love. Wanting me and only me. But instead there is exasperation in those eyes. Those blue eyes that look at me untrustingly, as if I've pulled a fast one on her, before she begins to cry. I slide a finger between her mouth and my breast, and attempt to reposition her, certain that she hasn't latched on correctly, I try cradling her in either arm and offer milk from either breast, and then when this doesn't work, I move Juliet and myself to the couch, where I lie on my back with her sprawled across my chest. Biological nurturing, or so it's called, the way nature prescribed. Just as my lactation consultant, Angela, suggested I do when Zoe had trouble nursing. I think of my lactation consultant, of Angela, of how I will phone her for advice if this doesn't work. And Angela will come, as she always used to do, and she will help position Juliet so that she will eat. She will once again explain to me breast compression to increase milk flow, and before I know it, Juliet will suckle as she used to do. And then there is a sound in the hallway, footsteps that are loud and impatient. And I curse Jennifer, sneaking into my building again when someone was coming or going, not even bothering this time to buzz the intercom or call my cell. Trespassing, I think, wondering where I've left my Swiss Army knife. I lie on the couch, with my black crepe dress pulled down to my waist, and Juliet floundering like a fish out of water on my chest, about to scream. There is no time to escape into the recesses of my bedroom for a place to hide before Juliet lets out a blood-curdling scream, and the front door flings open, and I see him, standing on the other side of the wooden door, staring at my attire, the black dress, the streaks of makeup dried to my skin, his mouth formed in the perfect loop, his eyebrows raised in question. His hair stands on end in a jumble as my heart beats fast, the room spinning laps around me. Juliet is screaming into my ear, her fitful body becoming hard to hold. Not Jennifer at all, but Chris.
Willow. That bus dropped us off in Chicago, the baby and me. Ruby, I reminded myself as I stepped out of the station and onto a bustling city street. It was cold outside, and windy. The Windy City, I called to mind, thinking of those days in the Omaha library with Matthew, looking up Chicago in the pages of the books. I'd never seen anything like Chicago in my whole entire life. There were people everywhere. Cars and buses, buildings that soared into the clouds. Skyscrapers, I told myself, knowing now where they got that name. I turned and over my shoulder I saw it, a building with antennas that scraped the sky. It had to be 100 floors or more, that building twice as high, 3 times as high, as any of those buildings in Omaha had been. It didn't take long to figure out I had nowhere to go. People stared at me, and it wasn't a stare that was kind or concerned, but mean. Judgmental, uncaring. I hid at first, the baby and me, in whatever dark alley we could find, leaned up against mildewed brick buildings beside doors that were locked and barred. There were smelly garbage bins and dumpsters down those alleys, and sometimes there were rats. I spent my days sitting on the concrete, wet from the rain, staring up at the steel grating of the fire escapes, and hiding. I was certain they were coming for us, that Paul and Lily Zeger were coming, that Joseph was coming. But it occurred to me then, after a day or two, that with all those people there in Chicago, there was no way they were ever going to find me. No way at all. And Joseph? Well, Joseph was still dead. And then, when I wasn't worrying about the Zegers coming for me or Joseph, I was worrying about other stuff, what to eat and where to sleep, for the money Matthew had given me was all but gone. It was cold out there, cold during the day, cold during the night, the wind making it hard sometimes to walk in a straight line. It took me only a night, maybe two, to figure out how I'd have to forage in the garbage for food after restaurants tossed their leftovers in the trash at closing time. I'd hover in the alley where they couldn't see, just waiting, begging the baby to keep quiet, and then I'd pick through the dumpster for something to eat. I saved whatever money I had left for the baby. For Ruby, for her bottles of formula. I was scared for about a million and one reasons, but the thing that scared me the most was that something might happen to that baby, something bad. I didn't want to hurt her. I was only doing what needed to be done, I reminded myself time and again when the baby spent the night in a fuss, screaming till she cried herself to sleep. I liked Chicago, I did. I liked the buildings and the anonymity of it, the fact that no one in the world was going to find me there in the Windy City. But it was the train that delighted me the most, that train that soared over the city streets, and then down, down, down underground. I spent nearly all my money on one of those train passes so that Ruby and I could ride the train as much as we pleased. The L, I heard someone or other call it, and I had to remind myself, L, when my brain started mixing it up with every other letter of the alphabet. R, P, Q. When the day was cold or rainy, or we were otherwise bored, we'd climb on the train, the baby and me, and ride. I realized quickly that there was a library there along the brown line of that train. It said so right on the map. Library. I was pretty sure it was an omen, a sign. I climbed up the steps to the train platform one cold, rainy April day after we'd been in the city a week, maybe two. I had that baby tucked up inside my coat to keep her dry and warm, and we waited there, on that platform, beside men and women with two big umbrellas and their briefcases and bags. They stared. They pointed fingers. They whispered. About the baby, about me. I looked away, pretended not to notice, letting my hair fall into my eyes so I couldn't see the way they stared, the way they pointed. The first train that came, it was too crowded. I didn't like the crowds, being so close to strangers that I could smell their perfume, their shampoo, being so close that they could smell my stench, days upon days of body odor and sweat, of the sour smell of spoiled milk and seafood that drifted from the garbage by which we slept, enfolding the baby and me in a noxious stench. And so I told the baby we'd wait. We'd wait for another one. And I stood there, watching as everyone else climbed on board, not a single one of them paying me the time of day. But then I saw it. A woman hesitated a split second before boarding that train, the only person in the whole entire city of Chicago who'd ever hesitated for me. But then she, too, climbed on board that train, and out the window she stared, at the baby and me. Though I looked away, my eyes like stone, pretending that I couldn't see. The next brown line train that came by, I got on, being hurled through Chicago and toward the library, a great big red brick building in the heart of the city, its green roof spotted with winged creatures that kept watch over me. But I wasn't scared. I didn't think I'd ever see that woman again. But then I did.
Chris. I'm utterly speechless. My mouth hanging open, my tongue unable to produce words. Heidi lays on her back on the living room sofa, completely topless. Some black dress I've never seen before pushed down beneath her chest. Her hair is in shambles, some kind of updo that has since come undone. Makeup dribbles down her face. Dark eyeliner I've never seen my wife wear. Dark lipstick that's smeared everywhere. The baby is screaming, out of control, and I have to remind myself that Heidi would never hurt that baby. Heidi loves babies. And yet I'm not so sure. I glance around our home, taking in the emptiness, entirely aware that the door to my office, to Willow's, a.k.a. Claire's, room, is sealed shut. Heidi? I say then, as I cautiously let myself into my own home and close the door. Where's Willow? I whisper in case Claire is there, hiding behind the closed door with a knife. I tell myself that Claire has done this, that Claire has rendered my wife topless, the baby frantic. And yet there are no restraints, no belts or cuffs binding Heidi to the couch. My words come out unsteady, without rhythm. I don't even know how they manage to emerge. My throat is dry, like sand. My tongue feels like it's grown to two times its size. An image of Cassidy Knudsen, half-naked, haunts me, alternating places with an image of a man and a woman stabbed to death in their bed. Heidi, I say again, and I see then the way that she presses that baby to her chest. Heidi would never hurt that baby, I remind myself again, paralyzed by the scene before me, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And then it comes to me, all of a sudden, what it is that Heidi's trying to do.
My God.
My heart stops beating altogether. I lose the ability to breathe. Suddenly, I'm bounding across the room, fully prepared to snatch that baby from Heidi's hands. Heidi rises to her feet all of a sudden, before I can catch her, clutching the baby like it's hers. I think of that birthmark on the baby's leg.
The doctor said we really might want to have it removed,
she's said. She and me. Like it was our baby they were talking about. Our baby. This was never about Willow, I realized then and there, that sudden, obsessive desire Heidi had to help some homeless girl she'd seen on the train. This was about the baby. And suddenly I'm not worried about Willow. Claire, hiding out on the other side of the office door. I'm worried Heidi has done something to hurt the girl.
Where's Willow?
I ask again, standing a foot, maybe two, shy of Heidi and the baby. And then again, when she doesn't answer, "Where's Willow, Heidi?" Heidi's voice is flat, nearly impossible to hear thanks to the baby, but I read her lips anyway, the simple proclamation,
"She's gone."
"Wake up, wake up, wake up!" My mind screams, certain this is only the after effects of last night's drinking binge. Certainly this can't be real. "She's gone," I repeat, more to myself than Heidi. And then, "Where?" And a dozen possibilities float through my head, a dozen possibilities that scare the shit out of me, each one worse than the next. But Heidi doesn't answer the question. The baby struggles in her arms. I grab a blanket from the arm of a chair and try to hand it to Heidi, to get her to cover up.
"Give me the baby,"
I say to my wife. And then, when she shakes her head and backs farther and farther away, toward the bay window, stepping on a cat's tail in the middle of retreat. A compromise.
"Just let me hold Ruby so you can fix your dress,"
I suggest, unprepared for the impetuousness that takes over Heidi's obliging brown eyes. Her eyes look demented, her skin flaming red. And then she begins to scream. Her words come out deranged, like some headcase you'd see on TV. Illogical terms that oddly make sense to me. There are words, baby, and Juliet. Juliet. She must say that word a dozen times or more. Juliet. She's pissed that I call that baby Ruby. The baby is not Ruby, Heidi reminds me. She's Juliet. But no, I think, recalling the article Martin Miller sent to me. This baby is not Ruby nor Juliet. This baby is Calla. "Heidi," I say, "this baby is..."
"Juliet!"
She snaps again, and again, and again. "Juliet!" She screams, frightening the baby all the more. I can hardly place the name, it's so far flung from memory. And yet it's there, in bits and pieces. Heidi, years ago, lying on a hospital bed, cloaked in a hospital gown, and tears. Heidi flushing her contraceptives, pill by pill down the john, pretending not to cry. But now she's calling me names, liar and murderer and thief. She doesn't mean to. I know she doesn't. And yet she's squeezing that baby unintentionally, and the baby is crying, howling like a wolf at the goddamn moon. And Heidi is crying, too, tears that flow down her cheeks like water down a drain.
"You're mistaken,"
I say, as gently as I can. Heidi has convinced herself that the baby, that this baby, is the one she lost 11 years ago to cancer. And I could explain the idiocy of this, the fact that that baby is dead, the fact that if that baby were still alive, he or she would be 11 years old. But I realize all too clearly that the woman standing before me is not my wife. I step forward and reach my hands out to the baby, but Heidi snatches her away.
"This baby, Heidi?"
This baby is not... And I could go on, but I don't. I'm terrified by the unstable look in her eyes, of what she might do to that baby, not intentionally. Heidi would never hurt a baby. Not intentionally, anyway. And yet, I don't know. Just let me hold the baby, I say, and then, to appease her, just let me hold Juliet. And I'm thinking of all the things I should have done when we lost that baby. I should have consoled her more, I think. That's what I should have done. I should have taken her to a shrink as her OBGYN said to do, among other things. But Heidi said she was okay. She said she was fine after we'd made the decision to abort that child so the doctor could treat Heidi's cancer. And yet I ignored the sadness I saw in her, the craving, the need. I figured if we ignored it, it would go away, like a stray cat, a pesky sibling. She's quiet for a moment, watching me. I'm certain she'll give in, if only I can convince her that it's for the baby's good. Let me make her a bottle, I say, my voice as soft as silk. She's hungry, Heidi. Just let me make her a bottle. The words come out pleading, desperate. But Heidi doesn't give in. She can read right through me. Heidi, who knows me so well. She brushes past me and into the kitchen, where she rummages through drawers. I grab her by an elbow as she passes by, but she shoves me in a way I never thought my wife capable of, enough that I lose my balance and almost fall. By the time I get my bearings, I find her in the middle of the kitchen, holding a Swiss Army knife in the palm of her hand, the sharp blade aimed at me. I should have seen this coming. I should have known. I go through the past few days in my head, trying to figure out what I overlooked, some desperate cry of Heidi's for help. A breakdown. That's what was happening. A mental breakdown. A psychotic break. But how did I not see it coming? Did I ignore the warning signs? Go away, Chris, she says. She doesn't have it in her to use that knife, or so I tell myself. But even I'm not sure. Heidi, I whisper. But she thrusts that knife into the air, stabbing the oxygen in the room. I glance at a clock on the wall and know that Zoe will be home soon. For once in my life, I don't think about me. I think about Heidi, Zoe, the baby. And I lunge. It's not enough to gain control, but enough to knock the knife out of her hand. It lands on the hardwood floor with a thunk, leaving a chip in the oak floor that we'll forever remember, a reminder of this day. We scramble for the knife, the both of us, the baby thrashing in Heidi's unstable hands, her cry slowly caving in to exhaustion and fear. I charge for the Swiss Army knife on the kitchen floor, sliding head first like a base runner into second base, coming up with it in my hands. And it's then that Heidi turns, before I have a chance to get to my feet, and sprints down the narrow hall, slamming the door and locking herself and the baby in the bedroom. She's crying. Heidi is crying. I can hear her through the door, sputtering some kind of mystifying diatribe about babies and Juliet, Cassidy and Graham, our neighbor, Graham, the man from next door. Graham. I could call Graham for help. But there is no time. I try to reason with her. Heidi, please, open the door. Let's talk. Let's just talk this out. But she won't be reasoned with. I think of all the pseudo-weapons that are in that room and the adjoining bathroom. Nail clippers, a nail file, electrical sockets. And then there are the windows, 5 floors up from the concrete below. I don't think twice. I reach for the phone and dial 911. It's my wife, I say desperately to the dispatcher on the other end of the line when she asks the nature of my emergency. I'm afraid she's... I don't know. She needs help, I say then, shaking my head quickly from side to side. I don't know what Heidi may do. Take her own life? Take the baby's life? 30 minutes ago, I would have said no, never, not Heidi. But now I didn't know. Just come, I command instead, and I rattle off the address. And then I hurry toward the bedroom door, fully prepared to knock it to the ground.
Heidi. I don't know what happens first. They take my blood. They hold me down on the starch-white gurney. Two men do. Two men in face masks and bouffant caps, their hands clad in latex gloves. They hold me down while a third injects a needle into me and takes my blood. He steals my blood from me. Chris stands idly by behind a utility cart as I kick and scream, thrusting my body from the bed until the men with the masks and the caps and the gloves press their weight into me until I can no longer move. Their alien faces stare at me, their massive hairless heads, their frightening opaque eyes. They have no mouths, no noses as they probe me with this and that, and I scream as Chris watches from afar, saying nothing. And then they sit me down at a table, a folding table of sorts, with three padded black chairs, a clock on the wall, the requisite one-way mirror you see on TV. Not the aliens. No, not the aliens. Someone else. Someone else entirely. I don't know what happens first. My daughter! I need to see my daughter! I continue to chant. But they say to me that if I cooperate, I'll be able to see my daughter soon. If I cooperate. But whether it happens before or after the blood, I don't know. I can't say. There's a woman there, an older woman with long silver hair, and I'm watching as my Julia gets passed from one person's arms to the next, before she disappears. Do something! I beg of Chris, but he ignores this, standing there in a room with dozens of desks and chairs. He ignores me, staring past me and through me, but never at me, as they lead me into a room and close the door where Chris can no longer see. I wonder if I am invisible. If that's the reason Chris cannot see me. Like air, oxygen, ghosts. Perhaps I am a ghost, an apparition. Perhaps I am dead. Perhaps they did not take my blood, but rather injected me with potassium chloride so that I would die, there on the gurney with the men in face masks. But my hands are bound in cuffs, and the woman with the long silver hair, she can see me. She asks questions about a Claire Dalloway, setting photographs on the table between us. Gruesome images taking up residence in my mind. Gory, bloody images of a man spilled across a bed, a woman beside him, her torso strewn upon his, each slathered with blood. Carmine blood, thick and gooey, absorbing into the tawny sheets. I remember the blood on Willow's undershirt, and I begin to scream. "Where have they taken the baby?" I cry out, trying in vain to free my hands from their cuffs, so that the handcuffs scrape the inner lining of my wrist. My hands are bound behind my back so that I can hardly move, a guard forcing me into my chair each time I attempt to stand, to rise from my perch and find my baby. "Where have they taken my Juliet?" I plead again when she fails to respond. And then I hear it, clear as day. I hear my baby cry. My eyes dash around the soundproofed room, searching every nook and cranny for my Juliet. She's here. She's here somewhere. "She's in good hands," the woman says, but she doesn't tell me where. I drop my head beneath the table to see. Is she there, hidden beneath the table? "Mrs. Wood?" the woman asks, tapping on the table to get my attention. She's impatient and short-tempered, this woman with her tape recorder and her felt-tip pens. "Mrs. Wood, what are you doing, Mrs. Wood?" But no, only a washed-out tile floor, varnished with coffee stains, and smut, grime, filth. "I need to see my baby," I say, rising up to look her in the eye. "I have to see my baby." There's a moment of silence. The woman, Louise Flores, the assistant state's attorney, or so she says she is, stares at me with dull gray eyes. And then, "You must be mistaken, Mrs. Wood. The baby you brought in," she tells me, "that baby is Calla Zeger. She is not your baby." And I'm gripped with a sudden onset of wrath and fury. And I find myself rising with great difficulty to my feet and screaming at her that she's wrong, that the baby is mine. Mine! I ignore the pain I feel in my arms, my back, as I stretch them in ways I didn't know I could move, like women whose children are pinned beneath cars, finding they can suddenly lift 4,000 pounds in a single motion, in one single hoist. A guard is coming at me quickly, ordering me to sit down. "Sit down now," he barks. And I see him then. I see him clearly. A perro de presa canario, with a coarse brindle coat bounding across the room, bearing razor-sharp teeth, growling, a rasping, gravelly growl. A warning. Slobber dribbles from his wide-open mouth, his teeth like spears, his eyes intent on his next meal. His hands are firm on me, on my shoulders, pressing me into the chair so that it hurts along the ridges of my shoulders, where his hands meet my flesh. And he bites. That presa canario does. He bites quickly, unexpectedly, tearing the skin so that blood runs its course down my arm. And I stare at that blood. Blood which the others, the woman, the man, do not see. Blood which is invisible. Like me. I sit, but I don't stay seated. I stand again from my chair and push past the guard, losing balance and crashing headfirst into the wall. "I need to see my daughter," I scream. "My daughter! My daughter!" Over and over again, maybe 1,000 times or more, before I fall to the ground in tears. And then that woman decides that she'll leave, then and there, with an autonomy that no longer belongs to me, rising from her chair. "I think we're through here," she says, her gray eyes not making contact with mine. I hear her say something about the need for a psych consult. The words delusional and disorder suffusing the room long after she leaves. And then the blood, and the gurney, and the men with the face masks and gloves. Aliens. My ears ring as they inject me with needles and probes. But what comes first, I can't say. I don't know what happens first. How Chris comes to loiter at the far end of the room behind the utility cart, watching as aliens inject me and take my blood, as they administer a lethal dose of potassium chloride so that I will die. "Stop them!" I demand of Chris. But he ignores this, again, as he ignores me, and once again, I am invisible. A phantom. A spook. My Chris, who never cries, is wet with tears. He stands, still as a statue, behind that utility cart, refusing to move. I'll never forgive him for this. And then I am tired. Oh, so very tired all of a sudden. The fatigue weighing on me like 1,000 bricks there on the gurney, while the men with the face masks and gloves watch. They watch as I stare at the tubular fluorescent lights that line the ceiling tiles, my eyes suddenly becoming too heavy to hold open, and I wonder in that final moment before I go to sleep, what else will they take from me? I want to beg Chris to stop them, to plead with him to do something, but I find that I can no longer speak. I awake in a room on a bed with a window that overlooks a green grassy park. A woman stands before that window in a pair of wide-leg pants and a button-down shirt, her back to me, staring out at the scenery. There is wallpaper on the walls, herringbone stripes and écru and sage, and hard wood on the floor. When I try to move, I find myself bound to the bed. The chime of metal on metal makes the woman turn to me, to stare at me with gracious green eyes and a smile. "Heidi," she says most pleasantly, as if we know one another, as if we're friends. But I don't know this woman. I don't know her at all. But I find that I like that smile, a smile that makes me half certain the men with the face masks, the woman with the questions, the potassium chloride and the dog, the Presa Canario with its coarse brindle hair, were all a dream. I peer down to my arms and find no blood, no cavernous teeth marks left in the skin, no bandages to stop the bleeding. My eyes bound around the sterile room, searching for Juliet, behind the sheer curtains, in the folds of the bedspread. "Where have they taken my baby?" I ask weakly, the words tired and paltry, my mouth like cotton. I can no longer scream. I pull dispiritedly on the handcuffs, trying to free myself from the bed. "They're for your own safety," the woman says as she moves closer and sits in a chair beside the bed. An armchair she pulls close, skidding it across the tile floor as she says to me, "You're in good hands, Heidi. You are safe. The baby is safe." And I don't know if it's the compassion in her voice or my overwhelming fatigue and despair, but I begin to weep. She snatches two and then three tissues from a dispenser on the bedside table and presses them to my face, for I cannot reach with my own hands. I pull away at first, away from this stranger's touch, but find myself leaning into it then, into the warmth of her hands, the softness of the tissue. She tells me her name, a name I instantly forget, save for the title that precedes it. Doctor. And yet she doesn't look like a doctor at all, for there is no lab coat, no stethoscope, no balding head.
"We just want to make you feel better, that's all," she says, her voice pleasant and accommodating, as she runs that tissue across my cheek and wipes the tears from my eyes.
Her hands, they smell of honey and coriander, reminding me of my mother's cooking. My mind drifts back to my childhood home, the chunky farm table around which the four of us sat. My mother, my father, my brother, and me. But my thoughts get stuck on my father. My father who is dead. I see the casket being lowered into the ground. Lavender roses in the palm of my hand, my mother beside me, ever stoic, waiting for me to disintegrate into a million pieces in that graveyard, the one saturated by rain. Or wait, I wonder, was it the other way around? Was I the one who watched my mother, waiting for her to disintegrate? I long to reach out and hold his wedding band, my father's wedding band, in the palm of my hand, to wrap my fingers around the golden chain. But I'm affixed to the bed and cannot budge. "Where is my baby?" I ask again, but she only says that she is safe. She tells me without my asking that she has kids too. Three of them. Two boys and a daughter named Maggie, only 3 months old. And it's only then that I notice the baby weight on the woman's otherwise slender frame. Baby weight that has yet to fade. It's this, the mention of her own children, that makes it easier to talk. Easier to reveal the secrets I've held inside for so long. "Ruby, Juliet, Ruby, Juliet."
And I remember then that famous Rubens vase.
And so we talk about the sleepless nights and the fatigue. I tell her that Juliet has yet to sleep through the night, though my thoughts are heavy and opaque, words trapped in the sky on a cloudy day. I explain how she's been ill, a urinary tract infection, I say, making it all the more difficult to console a child who's in pain. And the kind woman nods her head and agrees, and she tells me of her Maggie, born with a congenital heart disease, forced to undergo surgery just days after she left her mother's womb. And I know then that this doctor, she understands. She understands what I'm saying. And then she asks about Willow. Not in the way the other woman did, but kinder, more gentle. She asks when she left and why. Why did she leave? She asks. And so I tell her. I tell her about my father's wedding band and the golden chain, about discovering the filigree bird hook with its distressed red finish completely bare, though I knew that I'd hung the chain there. But no, I think, yanking again on hands that are bound to the bed in handcuffs, trying hard to peer down and prove to myself that the chain is there around my neck as it should be. I asked the woman for it, for my father's wedding band on the golden chain. But she peers beneath the neckline of a hospital gown and tells me there is no chain, no wedding band there. And it's then that my mind replays a scene, obscured somehow by fog, like a movie I'd seen in the past. The characters' names and title of the film long gone, but snippets of the movie left here and there in the recesses of my memory. Quotations, love scenes, a passionate kiss. But in this scene, I offer medication to Zoe on the palm of my hand, two oblong white pills, and then I watch from the edge of a bed as she thrusts the pills into her mouth without a glance. I watch as she swallows, then, with a long swig of water. And then I return to the bathroom to replace a prescription pill bottle into an open medicine cabinet, the word Ambien staring me straight in the eye, beside pain relievers, beside antihistamines. And then I quietly close the door. "Why didn't you report her to the police?" the woman asks when I tell her about the wedding ring. I shrug my shoulders, on the verge of tears, and say that I don't know. I don't know why I didn't call the police. But I do know, don't I? And then there I am again, closing the door to the medicine cabinet and watching Zoe, anesthetized by my Ambien and not an antihistamine at all, drift off to sleep so that she won't be awoken in the night. And I recall the words, my words running that night through my mind. There's no telling what the night will bring. I see myself remove the golden chain from around my neck and begin to hang it on the filigree bird, but then I don't. I stop just short and conceal it instead in the palm of my hand, kissing Zoe on the forehead in the adjoining master bedroom before I leave the room. And I step into the living room to find Willow in a chair, my Juliet sound asleep on the floor. I set to cleaning the remains of dinner, and in my visions, in this foggy memory, or maybe not a memory at all, but a daydream, a fantasy, as I discard leftover spaghetti into a plastic garbage bag, I watch from a distance as the golden wedding chain and band tumbles from my hand and into the garbage bag, commingling with hardening noodles and blood-red spaghetti sauce, and then I hoist the plastic bag out into the hall and down the garbage chute. But no, I think, shaking my head. That can't be. This is not true. Willow took my father's ring. She killed that man, and then she took my father's wedding ring. She is a murderer, a thief.
Is there more? The woman asks of me as she watches me shake my head from side to side, like the bob of a grandfather clock. Do you have any idea where Willow might be? It can't be. Willow took that ring. I remember then and there the way I sat on the edge of the bathtub, water running so that Zoe, sick with a cold or maybe allergies, would not hear me cry. The way I looked up and discovered the hook completely bare. The way I tried in vain to call Chris for advice. But he was too busy with Cassidy Knudsen to answer my call. I no longer know what's fact and what's fiction, fantasy or reality. I tell her that, no, I don't know where Willow is. I bark the words, suddenly furious and longing for my father. For my father to stroke my head and tell me that everything will be okay. It's all coming at me quickly now. Images of Willow, of Ruby, of Zoe, of Juliet. Images of blood and bodies and babies, unborn fetuses being removed from my womb. But that kind woman whose name I don't know, whose name I can't remember, it's then that she does stroke a hand over my head as my father would do. She says that everything will be all right, and I want to ask, Daddy? But I know what she would say, how she would look at me if I called her by my father's name. We'll figure it all out, she promises. And I find myself leaning into the mollifying words, finding the words themselves, the conciliatory tone of voice, to be exhausting, as I close my eyes and let them lull me back to sleep. By the time Chris arrives, it's dark outside, the world on the other side of the single window now black. You called them, I say, my quivering voice holding Chris responsible for this entire mess, for the fact that they've taken Juliet, my Juliet. You called the police! I scream at him and begin to curse, attempting in vain to rise from the bed and lunge at him, but finding instead that I'm tethered to it, my hands still bound to the bed in cuffs. Is that necessary? Chris asks of a nurse who passes through the room attending to the various tubing and needles that are injected into the veins of my arms, injected by aliens in face masks and bouffant caps. Is that really necessary? But the nurse says dryly, it's for her own protection. And I know what she says to him then, what she whispers to Chris then, about how she heard I ran headlong across a room and into the brick wall, as evidenced by a purple bruise now forming on the top of my head. She's agitated, the nurse says to Chris then, as if I can't hear, as if I'm not in the very same room. She's due for more medication soon. And I wonder what kind of medication. And whether or not they will hold me down on the bed and administer the medication with a syringe once again. Or whether I'll be allowed to take pills. Oblong pills in the palm of a hand. And I think again of the Ambien. Oh, I tell myself, antihistamines, pain relievers, not Ambien. I would never give Zoe sleeping pills. But I find that I don't know. You did this to me, I cry quietly. But Chris holds his hands up in the air, a look of innocence glued to his weary face. He's disheveled. The tidy appearance that usually describes his trim brown hair, his bright brown eyes and winsome smile, now clouded over with fatigue. Concern and something more, something I can't put my finger on. He could incriminate me, my Chris, who likes to point fingers and dodge blame. He could say that I was the one to lock myself in the bedroom with Juliet, but he does not. He could say he was worried I would hurt the baby, our baby, and I would laugh, wouldn't I? I would laugh, a cynical, mocking laugh, though he knows as well as I that I was standing there on the edge of a fire escape about to lose my balance when Chris forced himself into the bedroom. but he didn't tell the police about this when they arrived. No, he did not. He sits on the edge of my bed and reaches for my hand. And there I am, drowning, sinking farther and farther beneath the ocean's current, the waves washing over me while I scream silently, involuntarily drawing breaths, my throat in spasms, choking on mouthfuls of salt water that fill my lungs. "We're going to figure this out, Heidi," he says to me. Then, as he runs his fingers along my hand and up an arm, unaware of the way I gag and retch there on the bed, suffocating, I become submerged beneath the water while Chris and Zoe, the both of them, stand on the shore and watch. The nurse steps from the room, saying to Chris, "Just 5 minutes and then she needs to rest," before allowing the door to drift closed until it is just Chris and me. I hear her words, muffled from afar, and then the water again, a large breaking wave that pulls me under the sea. And I see Chris then. I see that he has spotted me from a distance, and he dives into the water, making his way ever so slowly to me. "Zoe needs you," he says, and then, after a pause, "I need you." Offering a life belt, something for me to hold on to as I flounder in rapid waters, trying desperately to swim.
Willow. It wasn't long before the police found me over on Michigan Avenue, staring through the windows of the Prada store. I was mesmerized. I couldn't move. Staring through the big old window of that shop, I couldn't think of anything else but seeing Mama in those fancy schmancy dresses, the ones that hung in the sparkly store window from headless mannequins. Oh, Mama would have loved those dresses. The police hung on to me for a little while, but they didn't keep me for long. Turned out that once again, I was a kid no one wanted. I celebrated my 17th birthday in a group home settled right in between Omaha and Lincoln, so that sometimes we'd drive on over to the Platte River and hike through the woodlands that overlooked that broad river that was usually filled up with mud. There were 12 of us girls in that group home, living with a husband and wife we called Nan and Joe. We all had chores that varied from week to week, like cleaning the kitchen or doing the wash. Nan cooked dinner for us each night, and each night we sat down around the table to eat, all of us at one big table like some kind of mismatching family. It was a lot like that home I found myself living in after Mama and Daddy died, except that this time, I wanted to be there. There were other folks who came and went, like Ms. Adler, and some nice lady named Kathy who wanted to talk again and again about the things that Joseph did to me. She made me say over and over again that this was not my fault, until one day, she said, I'd actually start believing those very words, believing that what Joseph did to me, it was wrong. Believing that what happened to my Lily, her getting adopted by the Zeger family and all, that was not my fault. Mama was not mad at me. In fact, she told me once, looking at me with a pair of emerald green eyes, "Your mama would be proud." But still, there were nights when I lay down in bed and I heard him, heard Joseph, sneaking into my room. I heard the squeal of the door, the grumble of floorboards beneath his feet, the sound of his huffing and puffing right on into my ear. I felt his damp, calloused hands yank the clothing from my body, heard his words crippling me, paralyzing me so that I couldn't scream. "And I that mocks a father and scorns to obey a mother will be picked out by the ravens of the valley and eaten by the vultures," he said, hissing the words right on into my ear until I'd wake up, in a sweat, searching everywhere in that room for Joseph, in the closet, and under the beds, sure that he was somewhere. Every single squeak and creak, every time someone or other got up to use the restroom, I was sure it was Joseph, coming for me, coming to slide his hot, beastly body in bed beside me, and it would take nearly forever for me to remember. Joseph was dead. I must have made myself say it 100 times a day, "Joseph is dead," until one day, maybe I'd start believing those words too. There were cupcakes for my birthday. Chocolate ones with chocolate icing, just like Mama used to make. In the days leading up to my birthday, Paul and Lily Zeger drove from their home in Fort Collins with Rose and Calla in tow. I wasn't allowed to see